Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And today we are re-airing a show that we did, I guess it was earlier this year, I believe.
Late fall 2019.
So we got news last week that JW, who started this show, finished his battle with cancer. And this is a tough time for his family. This is a tough time for us. And we've been both going back listening to old episodes because we're going to do a longer dedication show just for JW and all his contributions. But we wanted to revisit this show that we had, which was our last time sitting down with him.
Yeah.
And on the show. So, I've seen him since then. The last time I saw him was 2 weeks ago. But, so we asked that you keep us, keep his family in your prayers. He leaves behind a wife and three teenage sons. Mm-hmm. And the community, the village is rallying around them to support right now as we're preparing for his service. So, that's one of the reasons why you haven't really heard from us a lot. We've been dealing with a lot of life. And so, just wanted to hear from JW again because we felt it was appropriate.
Yes, it is.
And we will also, this week, we're dropping another show. But for our brother, we wanted to hear his voice again. So enjoy this re-airing of Faith Stories featuring JW.
Yes.
Welcome to Faith Uncut, a podcast where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
I'm JW.
What? We got somebody back in the studio.
What up?
For a very special episode of Faith Uncut, Faith Stories. Yes. Mr. JW is back. Yo, we've been trying to get you back for a while.
I ain't gonna lie, that felt good. Literally, like I was just, you know. I was like doing double dutch, waiting for my moment to come in.
And you didn't miss.
I felt good.
Yeah. So, for those who haven't gone back to listen to the beginning of the show, JW and I were the two that started the show. It was JW's voice the entire first season into the second season, and this is the foundation of what we built. And after a while, JW had to go away, and Amira had come on right before that. And so Amir and I have been the voices that you've heard since then. And since that time, we've referenced JW a few times, but I haven't really gotten into what's been going on with you since you left. And, you know, I didn't want folks to think that there was this big blow up and you left the show. It wasn't anything like that. It was
Not at all.
It wasn't my story to tell, but we are thankful that you reached out and wanted to tell your story today. And so here we are.
Here we are.
Yeah, man, let me just say this before we get into my story or whatever it is, but I love the show. Like, I'm a huge fan of the show. I was a huge fan of the show, obviously, when we started. I'm a huge fan of the show now. So literally, just listening to the two of y'all, like, no joke, like, I get giddy. So, like, literally sitting here with y'all, I'm having a fan moment. You have no idea. This is why I'm, like, trying not, I can't look at y'all in the eye yet at this moment.
That's amazing.
Because it just feels good, man. So, it's good to be back.
All right. So, let the people know what you've been up to since they haven't been hearing from you weekly.
Absolutely. So, let me start with this because, Mike, you brought up a good point. When I stopped doing the show, honestly, I had to stop because work was getting so out of control, not in a bad way. It's just, it was more responsibility and it was about to be more travel put on my plate. And I was having to work longer hours. And for me, if I can't commit to something fully, you know, I don't want to halfway do something. So I just felt like, and we had all talked kind of off the mic and I was like, I'm just going to have to pull back and focus it on the family and work and all of that. I'm not going to be able to do the show. So that was literally the only reason. I mean, like I said, I mean, I still love the show and still listen and read the comments and watch when people join the group and all that stuff. So that honestly, I still get excited about that. So that happened first. And then A little over a year ago, it was August 18th. My wife and I were going to this wedding, and I woke up that morning and I was in some pain. Well, to know me really good is if I'm in pain, I'll just shake it off for a minute. Mm. But I couldn't shake this off. So we go to the wedding and my wife's like, "You okay?" And I'm like, "I don't know, babe. We might have to go to the hospital." And she's like, "We might have to go to the hospital for you? Oh, this must be serious." And so as soon as the ceremony was over, we literally got our stuff and we went to the car. And she said, "Let me ask you a question. Who's driving to the hospital, you or me?" I was like, "You are." She's like, "Oh, Jesus, this has got to be bad."
Yeah, mm-hmm. She was measuring it.
Yeah, so okay. She was trying to figure out where was I, like where was the pain, how bad it was. Mm-hmm. And the fact that I said, "You're driving," told her pretty much everything she needed to know. So just to speed through that part, we get to the hospital. We're basically at the hospital for like 12, 13 hours. They run a bunch of tests. And you know, like when you're in the hospital for so long, you're just tired. You're just like, you're just done. Like, mm-hmm. you just let me out. Let me go home. And I saw the doctor approaching the room and the TV was on. And I made a joke when the doctor came in the room and he didn't smile, laugh or anything. He turned the TV off. And he just looked and he sat down and he went, "I think what we have is cancer." And he said, "Everything is showing us that you have cancer in your liver. I don't think this is where this started, but this is where it has spread." Mm. And he's like, "So you need to go have a colonoscopy as soon as you can." And I was like, "Well, it just so happens, doc, I got a colonoscopy scheduled for next week, but..." Mm. I didn't know this was what was going on. Mm-hmm. So have the colonoscopy a week later. They confirm, yes, it's cancer. And so our whole world is like rocked. Right. Like even in the emergency room, when he said cancer,
yeah,
like we were just sitting there stunned. Like it was like I couldn't, like yeah, I couldn't process. I couldn't like breathe. The only words I could literally form at that moment were, "Can I just go home? Mm. Can you just let me out?" And they were like, yeah, we can. We're going to give you a bunch of pain medication, but yeah. So have the colonoscopy. They confirm his cancer. I have the first appointment with this oncologist at this hospital in our local area. And this guy, I call him Doogie Howser. Mm. I call him Doogie Howser for a lot of reasons, but one of the main reasons is he's younger than me.
Yeah.
And he came into the room like he knew everything. Mm-hmm. And he didn't consult anybody. He literally sat in our face and he went, "So, this is really bad. There's nothing I can do."
What?
That's not how you start the conversation.
Like, literally. Like, this is, I mean, like, my man is in the room. He sits in the chair as close as we are now.
There was no cultural competence.
Forget cultural competence. Like, where are you...
Bedside
on the scale
manner.
Of yeah. bedside manner,
yeah,
to just come in and go, there's nothing we can do. Nobody's going to be able to do anything for you. Mm. Maybe we're talking some months.
Oh God!
But this is where we are, and I'm just sitting there like,
yo,
this is not happening. This is not happening. And he's like, "Now we're going to keep running tests. Start chemo. We'll do some things. Give you this medicine, but this is about it." And I was like, "All right." So when we left, I looked at Anita and I was like, "We got to get us a second opinion." Mm-hmm. So
yeah, that was so dismissive.
Yeah, it was just, I mean, honestly, it was real jacked up. So mm-hmm. we get a second opinion. We end up at a different hospital, Georgetown Hospital to be specific. And right before I was scheduled to have my first appointment at Georgetown. I was having, I think it was hiccups. Yeah, I was having hiccups that were just coming out of nowhere. Mm-hmm. And I'm in the ER. I'm there all night. They're running tests. The oncologist doesn't wait for us to come up to her. She comes down to the room and she literally looks and she leans in and she said, "I just want to let you know this is a team environment. Everything's going to be fine. We're going to work through this.
100% better.
We'll be okay." Mm-hmm. And then she looks at me again. She's like, "I'm telling you, we're going to be okay. You just got to listen to me. We'll be fine." And I looked at Anita. I was like, she's the one. Mm-hmm. this is where we needed to be. Mm-hmm. That other dude is fired. I don't want to talk to him. Yeah. You can talk to the office. They need to send everything they got to this lady. And so that was kind of the start of this journey, if you will, you know, down this road of cancer. I mean, like literally the initial reaction was just like, you know, it was just like a ton of bricks.
Right.
It's hard to kind of fathom because you see everything flashing before you. Mm-hmm. Like in those first 4 or 5 days, my mind actually went to my parents and my children. Mm-hmm. Because I started thinking things like, you don't want your parents to have to bury you. Mm. You don't want your children to see this.
Right.
Right.
And then it's like, I still got stuff to give them. I got a deposit. I got to teach them how to drive. Yeah. We gotta talk about some things. We gotta move through life. I need you to understand how you handle yourself in the street, in the world. And we've had those conversations, but it was at that moment I was like, I feel like I needed to have had more.
Yeah, you just feel like you're running out of time, or you're out of time at that point.
Yeah. I mean, like one of my big things was I was never a person to really enjoy and live in the moment. But once they gave me that diagnosis,
puts everything in perspective.
To hell with all that. At that moment, it's
every
moment matters, man. Right. Every single second of every day, enjoy it, live it to the fullest, because you don't know how much longer, you know, you don't know what you have.
You don't know what you have.
Yeah.
So coming out of the shock of the initial reaction, how have you managed introducing people to your new reality, you know, family and friends? How have you been communicating where you stand?
So the hardest conversation, probably a toss up between telling my mother and then telling my sons.
Okay.
My mother, because, you know, my mother, she's always one that, you know, she worries. She just, that's her thing. Mm-hmm. If you tell her, mama's going to worry about it. And I was like, I don't want her worrying. But I couldn't not tell her because this is where we are.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the first couple times, again, it was hard, man. It's hard to have that straightforward dialogue of, I have cancer. And oh, by the way, they were like, you have cancer and it's at stage 4. And it's just like, okay. And I was like, how did we get here? Mm-hmm. And when they look at you and the doctors go, we don't know. They said, because you didn't have any signs. I said, zero. Until the pain of that day, mm-hmm. I got nothing.
That's how my dad was.
I got nothing. And they were like, so.
Yeah.
And they were like, what about in your family? I was like, no, nobody has this. We got a lot of stuff, but this ain't on the list.
Yeah.
And they went, okay. And then somebody else comes in, another researcher, and they go, we're starting to see this in men younger and younger. And I was like, okay. So it was hard having the conversation at first to let people know. Mm-hmm. Again, part of that is I'm an introvert, so I keep stuff to myself.
Right.
And that's just my personality.
Yeah, period.
Right? Mm-hmm. It's just, no, everything's all right. I'm good.
Right.
People that are close, I'll let you in. But for some of that, it's like, no. But you can't hold this one, though.
Yeah, so speaking of that, so you and I both share that trait. We would sit behind these mics and talk, and then,
yeah.
I mean, we'll text each other, you know, throughout the week or whatever. But that was a tough one, because when I got that news, I mean, that just rocked me. I couldn't believe it. I mean, we're the same age. Yep. And it wasn't like I was thinking about it in terms of me, but I was like, how could this happen, you know, to him right now?
Yeah.
Especially, I think you were coming off a pretty bad year. So you this is tough, and being an introvert myself, like, I'm like, well, you go through the calculations. Well, I know a lot of people are trying to reach out to him. Let me give him some space, mm-hmm. you know, but at the same time wanting to be there and wanting to reach out and stuff like that. And I knew it was tough. So I was talking to Anita a lot. And my wife was talking to her and just trying to get, cause it's hard to when you figure everything that comes along with that. So it's not just the diagnosis. It's also what the diagnosis means, how it makes you feel, mm-hmm. the different states that it puts you in. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to navigate from the outside, less than, I'm sure, in the inside. But still, what are some of the better ways you receive support, you know, being an introvert, during this time when people may have wanted to reach out to you?
So I made a lot of mistakes. Mistakes in that people wanting to talk, wanting to help, wanting to be there. Mm-hmm. And for a while, because it was the way I was processing, I was shutting most people out.
Out.
Mm-hmm. Right? Mike, you could text me. I'm going to respond back to you within within some minutes, an hour. I had so many people texting me and calling. No joke. I just put the phone down.
Mm-hmm. White noise.
And Anita was like, you don't want to. I said, I can't. Everybody's asking me questions. Okay. I'm normally the guy, if you leave me for a second, I'll be able to come up with an answer. I'll be able to figure out something and help us all work through something. But this one, this was so much bigger. And so it became so overwhelming, people reaching out, that I didn't realize this for a while. Anita was fielding so many calls from family, friends, coworkers, former coworkers. Like, I'll give you one example. When I returned back to work in January of this year, this very senior person at the Department of Homeland Security, I can't give titles, but they're not a political, thank God. This very senior person pulls me, that was for you, Amir, I'm trying to bite my tongue, pulls me aside and she said, and she's fussing at me, like in her office, door wide open. She said, you let this happen again. I said, what happened again? That you're not taking people's phone calls. People wanted to help you. They wanted to be there. We were going to just come up one night in the middle of the night and I was going to dare anybody to stop me. And I went, you were going to do that in your position? She said, yeah,
for you,
because you have to let people in to some extent because they care. You can't be that selfish. I was like,
that's such a delicate balance,
though. Yeah, because there's a time to be selfish. Yeah. It's that time.
Yeah, I mean, like, don't get me wrong. That doesn't mean that I'm not at the point of just letting everybody
in. I can
see
that from both sides.
But I was able to see it from the side in which, and I was able to get her point. And so what it has helped me to do is to do better at responding. Now, I still have my moments. If people are sending a lot of things, I'm just like, okay, all right. Because sometimes you have people who are just, they're like the press to me. They're just asking questions just to ask. Yeah. They don't really care. So I have to try to not sift through, but I know people who really mean it.
Yeah.
And when those people who are, I know, are genuine about it, we dialogue. I respond, you know, as best I can.
Yeah.
It's also easier now than it was. I was diagnosed in August. September, October, and November were rough months.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of time in and out of the hospital. It really wasn't looking good.
Yeah.
And so that was really tough. At some point, I also had to come to grips with the fact that, do you believe the things you said you believed growing up?
Ooh.
Where are you right now?
Yeah.
Like, I'm literally asking myself that question. Nobody else could ask it like me. So I had to just sit there with it in hospital rooms and in the bedroom. And you just sit and look at the ceiling and it's like, do I really believe this?
Mm-hmm.
And in my heart to my core, nobody can convince me otherwise, I believe that I'm going to come through this.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a lot of examples and evidence and cases of it, but I believe I'm going to come through this, that this isn't the thing to take me out.
Mm-hmm.
And if I wasn't convinced of that, sometimes when I talk to the different people, because you'll talk to people and they mean well, and they'll just look at you and go, yeah, no, child, this ain't looking good, but you know Jesus, though, and it'll be all right. Dog, don't give me that, because that is as weak to me as it was when my wife and I, my wife obviously went through it physiologically, but went through the first miscarriage.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was like, you just need to just try again. Yeah. It's okay. God knows what he's doing. Mm-hmm. Amen. Ain't nobody got time for that right now. Just shut up and keep it moving.
So speaking of that, like, so this diagnosis came in August.
Yep.
So this is close, relatively close to the time when you stepped away from the show. What was going on in the dialogue in the show at the time, we were still beginning a lot of deconstruction. And it wasn't so much deconstruction of God so much as it was church and systems and structures and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So did that make it more, not the show, but did the fact that you were going through that type of analysis make it more difficult considering what you're experiencing during this time?
Yes, is the short answer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it did. I mean, it was just, So it's one thing when you just get to sit back and you just get to talk, mm-hmm. right? Mm. We were kind of talking about something off mic. I'll use it as an example. When I was watching football, mm-hmm. at some point I might be able to go back to it mm-hmm. and feel good about it. It's one thing to sit on the sidelines and talk about what the players are doing. Mm-hmm. It's a whole different animal when you're out there taking the hits. Mm-hmm. You got to throw the pass. You got to run the ball. You got to do whatever. It's just different. We can theorize and we can talk about theology and we can talk about the systems that churches put in place, whether they're good or bad. But it's a different thing when you have to now walk through this, because this meaning having cancer, mm-hmm. this ain't like having a cold, man. This isn't, you know,
right.
I can't shake this. This isn't like when I had a torn rotator cuff and some surgery or mm-hmm. physical therapy or both are going to heal it in 8 weeks.
Yeah.
This is completely different.
Yeah.
This is real. This is life or death. And so it really shook me for a moment, yeah. right? I never got to a point of saying, God, why? Like, why me as opposed to somebody else? But I would just get to these moments of, like, this is what we're doing?
Hmm.
Like, I didn't see this one coming. Like, this ain't in the script, Lord. Mm-hmm. Like, what's happening? And that is where, again, you have a lot of time to reflect. And so you have to sit back and legitimately wrestle with your whole belief system. Because I had a lot of people who would come up and say many different things. They weren't trying to be hurtful, but I realize that people really don't know what to say
yeah,
at some moments. And it's okay just to like sit. It really, really is okay to sit.
Some people aren't comfortable with their quiet though. They're not.
Yeah.
Introverts can do that. Hey guys, I can relate. Yeah. I perform extroverted yeah. most times, but I think it is a soothing thing to be able to sit in your quiet, even if it's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And for some people, that is actually a learned skill. You can teach that. Like churches who have ministries for sick and shut-in, mm-hmm. right? Sometimes the encouragement there is go check on mm-hmm. that person. But it doesn't necessarily mean talk them to death, be a busybody in their space. Some of the most helpful things you can do is just be in someone's presence, quiet with them, sharing that time. And something like this kind of brings, you know, people's character into contrast. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we have talked extensively about, like we said, not just about church culture, but, you know, exactly what are we doing here?
Yeah.
You know, what are we doing here when we talk about having a faith and going into worship and having a theological foundation from which we operate? I mean, I don't want to be super deep, but I think it's important to understand like these types of life-changing processes, mm-hmm. processes kind of change our view on who we think God is. Has there been any fundamental change for you, or has it come into sharp contrast who he is to you right now?
A sharp contrast. That's an excellent question. I don't know that anything changed per se.
Right.
What I can tell you is it brought things into more clarity, and it shook off some of the weaker parts of my own faith.
Okay.
I almost said the weaker parts of the faith, but that's a huge criticism I can't back up right now. But the weaker parts of my faith. So in other words, realizing that he still has to be, for me, he still has to be as much God today with cancer as he was before I had the cancer. Because it's not like I got cancer and he stopped being God. It's not like I got cancer and he stopped caring. I can't explain it all. So one of the things that has happened for me in terms of adding the clarity is I don't try to over-explain. If anything, my answers, when people ask certain questions, my answers probably become less wordy. Because truthfully, I realize there's a whole lot that I just don't know. I don't get. Just to kind of bring your question, Amira, back to also what Mike was asking me, I think having some people come around, sometimes some of the better experiences were when people would just come, they'd ask me, hey, how you doing? And then they would just sit.
Mm-hmm.
The TV's on. We're watching TV. They'd sit. if something happened in the room, the hospital room or in the house, and they could help with whatever that need was, they would just get up and do it. If that was walking my mom to the car, doing something, getting ice, getting a nurse, that mattered. Mm-hmm. What I didn't need was somebody trying to overanalyze what was happening in the moment. Because sometimes the talking is just, it's too much.
Empty words.
It's too much.
I mean, if doctors don't have the answers, you're not going to figure it out by asking a ton of questions. And just for an introvert, it does take work to just have conversations in general. I imagine, you know, going through the fatigue of your body being racked with this illness, that level of effort increases exponentially. So, yeah, talking is just tough. You know, I understand why it's better to sit there. Because if you're me, just, you know, the presence matters, but we don't have to talk.
No, I think that's what would actually drive me crazy. It's when I felt like I had to talk and now I have to perform.
Yeah, I have to.
You got to entertain.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, you got to host this.
Whoever's here. And I'm like, nobody feels like that. Because I had somebody ask, well, is it that you just don't want people, you just don't want people to see you in this condition?
Right.
No, man, it's not about the visual. I mean, the visual is what it is. No, I am who I am. The challenge is, I don't want to feel like, right, that I have to now be, I got to be the hype man in this conversation to help you feel better about
about me feeling bad.
About what's happening.
Yeah.
I mean, that part for me, that was kind of pushing it, right? Like that's where it was too much. Like I literally had people who would send so many messages at times where I was like, I can't respond. I think at some point, I probably didn't look at my phone for about a month and a half.
Yeah.
Like Anita was just telling me what she was seeing, who she was responding to or not. And I was like, that's fine. Because, I mean, a lot of it, man, you're doing a lot of like self-reflection and you're trying to, again, you're trying to be there. You're trying to be there. Even though I know that I will overcome this, I still realize that every moment is a gift. Mm-hmm. Man, so I just you take it, right? And like every day is also a fight. So you're tired also from the fight. So every day you got to fight to get up. You got to fight through the process. You got to fight through when you get bad news, cuz every time so I get chemo every 2 weeks. And at a certain point in April or March or April of this year, the chemo got to a point where it was working, but not as well. Around that same time, the oncologist at Georgetown told us about this online group to go, and it's a community of people who are going through this, and it'll be good for you. So I'm not the biggest social media person in the world. Like, I mean, I'll look, mm-hmm. I peruse, but sometimes I get tired of it. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really look, but Anita looked. Long story short, she was able to find this one smaller group and they were able to tell her about a specific treatment where they were having success at this hospital in New York. And we got connected, went up in May just to explore it, to see what would happen. We meet this new oncologist who I had never heard of this hospital. It's called Memorial Sloan Kettering. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of it. Mm-hmm. But every time I mention it, people are like, oh yeah, mm-hmm. I didn't know anything. Mm-hmm. So we go to that hospital, meet with this oncologist. She runs all these tests, looks at all the x-rays and CT scans. And she says, I tell you what we're going to do. We're going to do surgery, remove the primary tumor, put a pump in your body for the liver. Mm. And that pump will deliver chemo straight to the liver. And she said, we're going to do all of that. And Anita and I looked at each other and I went, you're going to remove the primary tumor out of the colon? And she said, yeah. I said, ma'am, they wouldn't do that at 3-4 hospitals in D.C.
Yeah.
She said, yeah, but you're not in D.C.
Yeah, you weren't there.
You're here.
Yes.
And I went, okay. So then she has a long line of patients. I thought the surgery wouldn't be until June, July. Mm-hmm. She looks at us and she says, my staff will try to get you in. They got us in before the month of May was over. Had the surgery.
That's excellent.
Surgery was a success. You know, I'm still recovering from it, trying to get up to full strength, got my appetite back. But things have been looking good. I mean, you know, the numbers, the cancer marker numbers in the blood have been coming down. she's very pleased with the progress. And so, you know, the journey continues, man.
You said that one of the hardest conversations was with your mom. How did it go with your sons? How was that as a father talking to your sons about something like this?
So I think I said this, it probably goes down for me as probably like in the top two hardest conversations I've ever had to have. So we called everybody into the living room and we just told them, I was like, listen, Dad's been in some pain for the past couple of days. They ran some tests and see, I was trying to be good. Mm. So trying to be good. Mm-hmm. Can't stand you for this question.
No, go ahead.
So we're all in the room and I said, yeah, so Dad has cancer. So the boys are really close in age. And so, but they're all different. So everybody has their own reaction. Mm-hmm. So my middle son, he's the one who, this boy swears that he's from the hood somewhere, even though he grew up in the suburbs. So, you know, so he's a G, so nothing bothers him. So he's just sitting there like, oh, all right, Dad. All right. But you good, though. I mean, I'm good, son, but yeah, but I have cancer. But yeah, I'm good. Mm-hmm. All right. Is the meeting over? Mm. That's his reaction. But that's just that exterior.
Yeah.
I know that boy.
He was screaming on the inside. Yeah.
And then my oldest son, he sat more in shock. Mm-hmm. And he'll kind of give you all of his things in the beginning. Well, what? And everybody teases me because they're like, he's the most like me. Well, what type of cancer? Mm-hmm. I mean, how do they know for sure? Do we need to run another test? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What hospital did you go to? How long have you known this information? I mean, he just went down like a list. Yeah. And so, you know, I just let everybody just process.
You're seeming a lot like you.
Right. Yeah. I just let him process. Just ask whatever you need to ask.
Yeah.
And so then at one point he stopped asking. And then I looked at my youngest son and I was like, you have anything you want to say? He just shook his head. I said, okay. Do you want to talk? No. Mm. Well, what was happening in his life was earlier that summer, his best friend's grandmother died of cancer.
Okay.
That was his first exposure, only exposure to cancer. Mm. So he is more messed up than I knew. So right after we told them, for like the next month and a half, 2 months, every Sunday night and some days during the week, he would come and get in our bed. And that wasn't really his thing. Mm. I mean, not like that, but he would come and get in the bed, wouldn't say anything, and would just watch TV.
Just wanted to be close.
Right. Yeah. It didn't click at first until I realized he was just sitting there not saying anything. And then his brothers would tease him like, man, you're too big to be in the bed. You can't be a 12-year-old.
They all wanted to get in there.
I'm sure they did.
Yeah.
They all wanted to get in.
But it was like,
it.
You can't be a 12-year-old in the bed.
Yeah.
And so it hit after a few weeks. I was like, oh, so I would tell them, stop teasing him. Give him his time. He's good. Does anybody else want to sit down? Nah, Dad, nah, we too old. Mm-hmm. But they're coming back every 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. What y'all watching? The same thing we were watching, son, 2 minutes ago. And nothing has changed. And then one night, my youngest, while laying there, he just starts crying, but he won't look at me. And I said, well, baby, what's wrong? Mm. I don't want to lose you, Dad. Mm. I said, well, baby, I'm not going anywhere right now. And at this moment, I'm right here. So we can talk, we can play, we can watch TV. It's fine. And so, you know, so then we would do that. And then every so often he'd come in, lay down, cry a little bit, watch TV. And then it was helping us both to process and kind of go through that at the moment. Well, I guess all three of us, because Anita was right there too. Mm-hmm. So that's why, like, that one was hard because it's like they're in the house. And so everybody, like I said, processes different. Mm-hmm. My middle son, he will just come to the edge of the room and just peek in. And then if he sees you looking, you know, he just walks away. Mm-hmm. I was like, you good, son? Oh, yeah, I'm straight. Ain't nothing wrong. You need something, Dad? No, I don't need anything. I mean, just take some of the bass out. Just relax, man. Just, I mean, nobody's challenging who you are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, but that's the way that he has always processed things. So, yeah, so that one was the hardest one. And I don't know if I said this, but also in this same year process. So by now it's been 13 months. My dad passed away in December. And like that, at that point, I was like, okay, now, Lord, you know what? No, this ain't right.
Yeah.
This is too much. This is too much.
Mm-hmm.
We can't process all of this. And because I was just coming out of the hospital so many times, I couldn't even go see him at these last few moments in the hospital. I couldn't go because they were like, you can't be around that.
Wow.
So if I went, I'd have to go with the mask and everything. So I would go, but I wasn't able to be there as much as I wanted to. So, yeah, man, I mean, it was a wild ending to 18 and, 19. I would say 19 has been bad, but I'd be lying to you because I've been able to see every day so far. So I can't say it's bad.
Yeah, it's tough because this conversation, I'm thinking back to different times throughout this process. And I guess it's related now. You did an excellent job, and I told you before, at your father's, your father's eulogy. I mean, it was incredible. That was probably one of the best eulogies I've ever heard. And
thank you, man.
And to know that you were going through what you were going through at the time, and then having to do all this, I was like, man, just let them get out of 2018. Like, just let that
year. Yeah, bro.
Let that year be over. Wait a minute. That was 2018, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I just wanted that whole year to be over. I was like, this is a lot.
Yeah, like that one was tough because I had promised my dad. This was like 7, 8, 9 years ago. I was at my parents' house, and my parents are planners. Like, that's just always how they've been. So my dad, one day, we're watching TV, and my dad doesn't even look at me. Mm. I'm looking at TV, but I could tell he's looking at something else. He's like, oh, yeah, by the way, will you, you'll be okay doing my eulogy, right?
Mm.
I didn't even respond, because I'm like, I keep telling these people, I want to keep talking about what's going to happen when you die. Like, this is a bad episode of Good Times. Like, let's just, we just ain't going to talk about funerals, man.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't answer. My mother's like, did you hear your father? Yes, ma'am, I heard him. And he said, well, I said, sure. I didn't forget about it. But when he passed away, and my mother at the hospital leans over to me and she's like, all right, I know what you're thinking. Okay, what am I thinking? That you gave your father your word. And I was like, I did. She's like, baby, but I don't think you can do this right now. I said, well, there's only one problem. Dad raised us that if you give your word, you got to keep your word. So I told him I was going to do this. So I'm going to do this. And so, she didn't like that answer. So she called my mentor up on the phone. He drives all the way up to the hospital, pulls me into the hallway. Are you sure you're ready to do this? I said, yeah. Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, I said, I'm going to do the best I can.
Yeah.
I said, now I will be ridiculously tired when it's over.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so no, that was hard. That was hard, man. That was hard.
Yeah, watching you go through that was a major factor in, because my mom passed right after that.
Yeah.
In me deciding to, I wanted to speak. Well, I wanted to speak, but being able to speak was a different thing. And seeing what you did was like, yo, yeah, if he can do that, then I know I can do this.
Yo, you did it.
It was, because it wasn't a eulogy for me. It was just, remarks. But
you did it, man.
Wow, this is a lot.
It's so much love in here, though. Oh, my God. I'm overwhelmed. Go ahead.
All right. So right now, you're saying, well, you've always been optimistic. And based on the progress, you're even more optimistic now.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. I still have my days where it's the reality of you have cancer, right? You don't know what tomorrow holds. You don't know that there is a tomorrow. But I have come to grips with the fact you got to hold on to something. So I could either have nothing but self-pity every single day, or I can enjoy and live in the moment and try to progress in that fashion. So yes, I am optimistic. And yes, I do feel good about the fact that I'm seeing the progress. So seeing the progress helps my optimism, right? It probably helps to feed it, if anything.
Right.
Right. If things were getting worse and worse, it would make it harder. But I also know me. It would be really hard to turn the light completely out. It would be really hard because I got to believe in something. It's too much. It's too much for me to go, forget it. I just can't do that. I can't do that. As bad as things are politically in our country and just the reality of our country, I got to believe at some point this is going to turn around and be better. I have to. Doesn't mean I don't recognize the hell it is now.
Right.
And the disaster it is now. No, it's a disaster.
Right.
It's pitiful. Mm-hmm. I don't know when it happens, but at some point there's got to be some glimmer of hope. If that glimmer is enough racist Republican Christian conservative men and a few women lose their seats.
Amen.
That helps.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, that sounded like a powerful prayer.
That helps. Right? Powerful. Like that'll help. That'll give me some hope. Mm-hmm. That'll give me some hope that this is going to get better.
Man, I miss you on this show. I mean, I see you and I talk to you, but man, I miss you on this show. Thank you for, I'm not going to keep you out here because I know the effort that it takes to get here, but I needed this. This was good. Thank you.
And I appreciate you being here.
Thank you for sharing this with us.
Thank y'all, man.
Incredible. For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
And I'm JW.
For more on Faith Uncut, check us out at faithuncut.com.
Like, when I watched the Netflix documentary on The Black Godfather, I literally was like, that could easily have been my dad. Right? Because everybody would come to him for things and he'd help put pieces together. But what was happening was people always wanted to be that, even in the family. So when he passed away and, you know, I have cancer, people are coming up in the family trying to do that. But the challenge is what you just said. People would come up like, yeah, I remember when I had cancer. Yeah. Yeah. I would only eat two or three things. All right. And now we've gone 5 miles down the road of talking nothing but about their condition. Now, truthfully, and this is wrong, but I will admit my faults. I'm going to let you go. I'm not going to stop you. Matter of fact, I'm going to keep helping you. Like, yeah, then what happened? What? And then what they do? Every time I do that, I'm focusing back on TV.
Yeah.
I was schooled well by the government on how to do this, so I focus right back. Come right back. You know, that is a good point. Mm-hmm. I like that. You got to tell somebody that story. And then I'm right back. I'm right back. I'm right back in the TV. Mm-hmm. But the thing is, you're right. People would, you know.
Yeah, but they just don't know how to, you know.
Because it's hard, man.
It is. I've always said I'm a crisis friend, you know, but I can't be that to everyone.
Right.
Because I don't think everybody's meant to be.
True.
But if you really know how to deal with your people, then you know how to be quiet with them. It's so much value in that. My mom, and then maybe she's the role model. My grandmother, quiet with you, but with you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're going to sit. Feel like talking, I respond.
I said this at my dad's funeral, but it's true. Somebody thought I was kidding. My dad used to teach people how to visit the sick and shut in. He would be extreme, but he said he was trying to make a point. You got 7 minutes to visit with the person. Yep. You're going to sit there. You're going to listen. You can pray. And then you out.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Get in, get out.
But don't you dare stay there longer than 7 minutes. And anytime, any deacon, any minister would stay for longer, that dude would pull you aside after it was over.
I say too much.
You know I said seven, don't you? I meant that. These people don't want to hear you. They don't want to hear you talk. Just sit there, man. You ain't got to be there all day. But, you know, like I said, I think people just don't know. People just don't know what to do. And so in their nervousness and anxiety, it's, let me just fill the void with some noise. Mm-mm. Nah, man. So, listen. This dude, not just because he's sitting here, some of the best visits when he came. Some of the best visits.
I don't believe that.
I just felt like coming to see you, like, I'm like, man, this dude, has to live this all the time. He has to retell the same story so many times. And just when I get to you, I just want to just talk to you. Like,
right.
we still living yep. life, but let's just talk about life and see how it goes. Like, that's, I mean.
Dude, I'm in the hospital sitting there like, yo, this dude's in seminary. They're like, yo, that sounds great. I'm literally living through him as he's telling me these stories. I'm like, yo, that sounds good. I might have to go ahead and enroll.
Right.
And at one point, I said this to Anita. She's like, nigga, it's September. Nigga, we in the hospital. How you gonna just go? I don't know. Okay, don't ask me them questions. Okay. But what I'm saying is, it sounds good.
Okay.
And so,
I'm gonna do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, cause I also, like, Anita is the hero. I mean, the fact that she found that oncologist and all that stuff.
Dude,
then,
I could literally, I could do 30 minutes on just her, because even when I was in the hospital, when I was admitted those couple times way before New York, doctors are limited in their knowledge, and sometimes they have the same faults as us. Mm-hmm. Which is that if they don't know something, they just want to fill it with a void. Mm-hmm. And so they would, at one point, they prescribed a medication that was causing me to, like, hallucinate. And she was like, we're not going to do this anymore. And she had told the people, don't give them this. She stepped away to do whatever she had to do, comes back. They gave it to me. I didn't notice till afterwards, lit those people up, tore them a new one. I only knew this because several days later, the head of one of these surgical units comes by and he's like, yo, your wife is a superhero. And I was like, yeah. And he kept talking for like 20 minutes
about the impression she made.
And I was like, bro, I'm feeling some kind of way, dog. Like, I know I'm in this bed and you the doctor, but I promise you I will swing some at you because I think you are infatuated with my wife. And he was literally like, yo, like, she is a genius. She would do research, come in and tell them, did you look at this study? Did you look at this one? This is what this causes. This is what happens here. And it was making these people who have been doing this for 15, 20 years go, well, you know, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. Like, she's...
I mean, this whole time...
She got superhero qualities, man.
The whole time I've been like, yo, that's incredible. So, like, when we first found out, you know, everyone was like, yo, what can we do or whatever? A lot of people want to cook. Whatever. So instead of fielding all those calls, Anita was like, here, just go to this website and sign up. So she had created this list.
This meal train thing.
So we all just went on and signed up for our times and days that we wanted to send out meals. She ain't had to worry about it, because I know she's fielding a whole bunch of other calls from everyone else. And we got there, just delivered. She had instructions for what we needed to do, just deliver the food, drop it off, and then come back your next scheduled time or whatever. I was like, yo, that's brilliant. Oh my God.
What's her profession?
Psych major. She was a psychology major. She used to work for a nonprofit in DC that worked with the lower, like, 5% of high school students to help them graduate.
Okay.
Once we had our sons, she pulled back from that. She stayed at home.
Okay.
And then she started real estate a few years ago. Mm. Yeah. But I mean, no, man, I tell her all
your
the time.
Field general, if she can do
She's
that.
Brilliant, man.
The other thing that I was, like, really impressed with. So we texting, and she's like, you know, she found this oncologist. We going up to do this or whatever. She gives me updates when I can't get to you. And so she's like, all right, yeah, so just pray for me because I got to drive all the way to New York, right? And so I start laughing when I text. I'm laughing, right? And she was like, no, I'm not laughing. I don't feel comfortable driving to New York. I don't think that I can do this or whatever. And, you know, I didn't think that it was a thing for her, but she's doing this super huge, and that's not a short trip. You know, you're from New York. I mean, she found the doctor, you know, did all stuff. I'm sure she's getting stuff ready in the house, making sure that she's calling me to make sure that the boys are taken care of when they're gone. I mean, when y'all are gone to New York. And then doing this drive that she really don't want to do. And I was just like, dang, you're really, really, y'all are good. She's really good.
Dude,
I need y'all to have this conversation about the value of a spouse. And it's going to be an episode. For real. Because
I will come back to do that.
This be the stuff. My father did not marry my mother, and it's probably the way it was supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
But when he was sick,
mm-hmm.
he used to call her all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and even before that, like, people just kind of knew, like, that that's the one that got away. But being their child, like, going to visit him
yeah.
and, you know, watching him age, and it gets to a point where a person don't even know what they're doing sure. in the middle of the night. He did not see the value in his youth. For
yeah.
a wife,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's about more than just her service, yeah. right? It is about her brilliance yeah. when you didn't even know what mm-hmm. she could do. And I just feel like some, you know, either you get it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not talking about people, you know, because I feel like not that they're one and the same, but you see that same value in Lynette. So it's just like, we're not talking about people y'all just met.
Mm-hmm.
These are the long-standing, deep-rooted, you know, relationships that you end up fighting for. You learn better. You do better.
Yeah.
And you didn't see this coming.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? But even as you were unfolding the story, she was with you as you learned what was happening to you.
Yeah.
She became the other voice. I heard it just as sure as he did because I was right there. So it's just like, you don't see the value in this.
And it's tough for her, too. Like, I know.
It's extremely tough.
Yeah, she's letting me know, like, this is rough. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah.
No,
yeah, because it's like, because now your life stops in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the focus, you know, a lot of the focus is all on me.
Yeah.
And I'm just like it's, we'll find times to laugh at it now.
Mm.
Doctor's offices, they don't even call me anymore. They literally are calling her.
Mm.
And one day they called her phone and she's talking. Yeah, the doctor called her phone. She calls me to patch me in three-way because she was on her way to the grocery store or something. And I said to the doctor, you know that I am the patient?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you calling her and not me? It's me. You have my number. Uh-uh. They were like, yeah, we understand
she's
that, sir.
Your advocate.
I was like, that's all you got? They were like, would it's you like amazing, us to say something no. else? And I went, it's, actually, no, you're right. You were right to call her.
Go ahead.
The not just the role, but the I don't know what to call it. The spouse is also put under the pressure of mm-hmm. of everything, and then there's a different type of effort exerted when you're the spouse, when you're
yeah.
when you're the person who is not like in the bed and doing yeah. all these other things, and no one really checks on that person. Like, they always want to check on the person that they know about,
right?
But they don't stop to think about the other person that they're talking to.
It might not be their first thought. When we talk about caregiving,
yeah.
we try to emphasize checking on the caregiver because they're the vessel. You want to fill them back up so they can keep providing care. But the approach rooted in that relationship, this is all I'm saying.
Mm.
People, it's very easy to not see the value of something. I got time. I have time for that. Y'all are not in y'all 60s. You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
So again, this is not somebody, I just married the other day. And even a wife you meet the other day, you know what I'm saying? A right. year-long relationship. You can get this out of somebody. But I think there is value to just acknowledging, like, this is one of those hidden aspects.
Yeah.
It's somebody to walk, you know,
yeah.
the more treacherous parts of the road with. Not just the other stuff. Not just the financial stuff.
Yeah.
You know, the kids and all of that.
Yep.
This is very intimate.
Partnering is...
Yeah. Like,
that joint is not just economic union. It's not just, you know, for sex or whatever. Like, this type of stuff
is
infinite value in this. This
is VIP.
Like, I've told her on a number of occasions... I would not have made it this far without her. And that ain't me blowing smoke.
Yeah.
I ain't trying to be nice in front of people. I done told her that privately because I'm like, I just wouldn't have made it. I wouldn't have made it for my own sanity. Because like you said, when you're the one in the bed,
mm-hmm.
you can't always ask all the questions. You can't always see everything that's coming. You can't process it that way. But having somebody beside you who looks and goes... And they see things and they'll call them out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just like literally there were times in the hospital, like, you know, I'm a grown man. So, I mean, I can talk. I know how to talk, handle my business. I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to me, y'all. There are times I was just sitting there in the hospital bed in awe. They would come ask questions about, so, sir, how are you feeling? They would be looking at me and then they would look at her.
Mm-hmm.
And then she would start talking. Well, I would just sit there.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, I'm good because she's going to tell you everything that I just said. So I literally at times would just twice, yeah. I would just watch her and watch mm-hmm. them.
Oh, I love
it. And they would just, you know, take their notes and move on.
Yeah, well, we do have a show about that on this season.
I guess I should.
On what? Like, what specifically? On the
benefits of partnering, the benefits of marriage and things like that. Like,
call me. I'll come for that.